Yeah, because different kinds of potatoes are for different things. Like some are more stay hard and some are better for.
If I work at Drink Orange Juice, definitely pulp.
Hi, you are listening to The Gastro Girls
on CKUT.
We are looking at the way you view food, you buy food, you produce food, and everything in between.
Like your stomachs.
Chesley and I went out to document some food producers in the Toronto area.
And eat their food too.
Hi, my name is Nicole.
And I'm Chesley.
And I go to the University of Gastronomic Sciences in Bra, Italy, where I study food ecology. Our university was set up about 5 years ago by the Slow Food Movement. Slow Food is an international non-governmental organization which aims to defend and expand good, clean and fair food. Good for your head, hands and heart, clean for the environment and fair for all the people involved. You might have seen the red snail, which is its logo, on your local farmer's market. Some key figures within our movement are Vandana Shiva, Wendell Berry and Carlo Petrini, and also Michael Pollan, who tends to be the most known in Northern America.
Michael Pollan spends the pages of his book The Omnivore's Dilemma narrating the stories of three different meals: the industrial, the organic, and the personal. These three meals are traced from the soil to the stomach, digging into the roots of the global food economy and embracing the possibilities of food harvested from your backyard. Throughout this research, Pollan brings the blurry picture of food production and consumption into focus, at least as far as he's able. Speaking of McDonald's, a giant no global tale on food could skirt, Pollan touches upon the intentions of the blurry picture. He says, "To go from the chicken to the chicken McNugget is to leave this world in a journey of forgetting that could hardly be more costly, not only in terms of the animal's pain, but in our pleasure too. But forgetting, or not knowing in the first place, is what the industrial food chain is all about." Michael Pollan's research took years and quite a bit of money to accomplish. So trying to tackle the giant of industrial food systems seemed like a stretch. Instead, we will be exploring the local food movement and trying to figure out what that even means. So throughout the show, we'll be looking at various issues about what organic means to different food producers and farmers, the difficulties of farming today, the difficulties of farming and distributing your food in a sustainable manner. We'll also talk to people who have tackled the issues of an opaque industrial food system and are looking to make food culture far more transparent than it is right now. In sum, we tried to investigate some of the aspects of Pollan's research. Specifically, we're trying to look at how people, or how we, can cultivate a relationship with food that's a little more personal than it has been for, at least me, an American, growing up for the last 23 years. Knowing where your food comes from is a serious undertaking, as we realized on this journey.
Not ripe yet, but you can taste a lot of flavor.
Well, there's two ladders.
So glad we ran into you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
The Two Century Farm is a short distance off Highway 8 in the Greenbelt region of Ontario. Duncan Smith, the owner who greets us as we drive on, has run this cherry farm for most of his life. You can tell by meeting him and his daughter Alyssa that they live and work the land and know it intimately.
Now we're a full, not a
good farmer. Now, from Grimsby this way.
Most of what Duncan discusses with us involves failing crops, falling prices, and a grimly realistic understanding of small-scale agriculture. But after telling us of the newest fatal fungi, he always breaks into a big smile and plucks us each an apricot. At one point, he duck walks over and instructs me to wash my hands by mashing sour cherries between my fingers, as he vigorously demonstrates.
And the soils are different enough from below the escarpment to the top of the escarpment that there really are not, there is not any tender fruit growing up on top of the escarpment.
There's something thrilling about being around people who understand the land they live on as well as Duncan Smith does. He and his daughter Alyssa have a keen understanding of how and why tender fruit can develop at the base of the Niagara Escarpment, the long, low mountain fencing in the Smith's farm. It's also extremely comforting to know that this family has maintained and continues to work this land. For two centuries, it's been in the Smith's possession. But as progress would have it, an encroaching highway, other farms, and of course the inevitable division of land, the two-century farm suffers from decreased acreage. The loss of land is a particular hardship for growing cherry trees, as Duncan explains, as it leaves his fruits more susceptible to disease. Duncan also explains to us how difficult the pressures of going organic can be, particularly with growing cherries.
Is this like disease?
Okay,
here?
Well, no, this is actually from, this is fungi.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just from humidity.
Okay.
See, unfortunately, the direction of agriculture is towards organics, but in southern Ontario, we have too much of a humid climate to be able to do that. And there aren't enough registered organic fungicides that aren't actually detrimental to the environment. Mm-hmm. Like, I believe one of the ones is copper sulfate, and another one is sulfur. And if you've ever had the luxury to use either of those two chemicals, they are nasty.
Yeah, they build up in your soil.
Oh, well, copper sulfate, sulfur ends up acidifying your soil. It's hard on beneficial mites. It washes off from the fruit after every rain, so you have to reapply it moments afterwards. It only has a lifespan of about 3 days, so you're always on a sprayer, you're always and you have to put
because there was so much rain this year in the spring, bees were only able to pollinate for 2 days. Therefore, only one third of the cherry trees set fruit. Duncan explains to us that if he breaks even at the end of the financial year, then that has been a good year. This financial situation, together with the problems of pollination and fungi, don't paint a pretty picture. One might wonder why any young people still want to go into the business of farming.
Have a bite. you're just going to have delicious. They're just going to have to go for little bites out of stuff.
The Smith family makes it seem that it's not as much a business as it is a lifestyle. Duncan says to be in a rush since he promised his wife he would take the afternoon off, but nevertheless he keeps popping up during our picking session. It is fun to see the sheer pleasure he takes in feeding us snippets of information about soil, trees and fungi, as well as plump pink peaches that he found. And this joy for the work and the eye for craftsmanship is something that also sparks off his daughter Alyssa, who just finished her agricultural studies out in BC. She wrote a poem to celebrate her farm's 200th birthday and us if she can read it for the radio.
Do it!
Okay. But I wrote it on July 11th because that's the farm's 222nd birthday. Okay, and I'm not really a poet, but I just wanted to do something special. Okay, so. Peach, apple, pear, and grape, it's 222 years to the date that John Smith came on a mission so great. Some call it destiny, some call it fate. Deeded the land from some distant king, John Smith ventured north to do his settler thing, transforming soil, water, sunlight, and air into fruits and vegetables so rare. John begot Ezekiel, you see, and the rest is history. Fast forward a couple centuries and our farm is still magical. I think you'll agree. Patrilineal though they may be, our forefathers have done a great deed. But the Smiths were a lottie knot, not as straight-backed and biblical as I'd always thought. Sardis's brother left his father to rot, and one aunt was high more often than not. Despite some foul play, we stand here today to honor our blessed farm, left life, blood,
Alyssa's poem drew together the two world views of farming,
bunnies, sunsets,
realism,
and flowers,
and perpetual
trees,
faith.
And spring showers,
by that I mean, while Alyssa still has a realistic understanding of how difficult it is to make money on the farm, she approaches the farm's future with youthful optimism and humor.
Let's watch together as the future unfolds.
What prompted her poem was a brief discussion about future family subdivisions.
Do you have brothers or sisters that are interested in the farm?
I have a brother, he's not interested. And I have like 13 cousins too, and neither of them are interested. It's all yours. Dumb eyes. Yeah.
And what if you wouldn't have been interested?
Great. No, there's got to be some way you can make money on this farm, like, really. But, like, when my grandpa dies, the farm will be divided between all my aunts and uncles and stuff. And the three aunts would like to sell as soon as possible. So I don't know if it ever stops being green belted, then about half the farm will be turned into subdivisions. Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah. Returning to Pollen's point about food and forgetfulness, Alyssa's chronology of her family's history on the farm proves that memory is an essential aspect to the production of food at the two-century farm.
Back in 1927, I had a little farm and I called it heaven. Prices up and rain come down and I hauled my crops all into town. I got the money. Bought clothes and groceries. Fed the kids, took it easy. The rain it quit and the wind got high and the black old dust storms filled the sky and I swapped my farm for a Ford machine and I filled it full of this gas I lean and started. Rolling and drifting to California. Way up yonder on a mountain road, I had a hot motor and a heavy load. I was going pretty fast, I wasn't even stopping. I was bouncing up and down like popcorn a popping, had a breakdown. Sort of a nervous bust down of the mechanism there, some kind of engine trouble. His way up yonder on the mountain road, I wasn't feeling so very good, and I give this rolling Ford a shove, and I was gonna coast as far as I could. Commenced rolling, picking up speed, and there was a hairpin turn, and I couldn't make it. Man alive, I'm telling you, the fiddles and the guitars really flew. That Ford took off like a flying squirrel and it flew halfway around the world. Scattered wives and children's all over the side of that mountain.
One of the most memorable things I took from our day at the 21st Century Family Farm was the understanding that Duncan was a craftsman and he was very able to explain to us why he had made certain choices in his farming. He explained why he didn't go full-style organic, and he explained why he didn't use every pesticide he could. And I felt very comfortable eating his cherries and trusting his expertise on how they were grown.
Particularly when they were soaked in alcohol.
Yeah, those were good.
That helped.
They were very potent.
Ultimately, meeting Duncan and his daughter, and learning as much as we did about growing cherries in the area and all the difficulties that go along with running a family farm, we learned kind of by accident. We actually went to interview Paul DeCampo, who suggested that we go out to the two-century farm from which he got produce for his Good Food Box, a program based out of Toronto that he started in the early 90s.
So this is the two-century farm. It's D. Smith and Sons, and Duncan is actually the son. Mm-hmm. And we're standing at the base of the Niagara Escarpment. So we're between what's traditionally known as Highway 8 and this ridge that's covered with trees.
If we take into account the fact that we throw away excessive amounts of our food, and if we look at the numbers of the World Health Organization, which show that a large number of the world population is obese, and about the same amount of people are undernourished, then maybe it is time to reassess our approach to feeding the world. Maybe producing more is not the only answer, if this means that food will be locked away in a market and only available with hard cash. Hunger is as much a political and economic problem as it is an agricultural one. Paul works for the Good Food Box program, which is an original approach to delivering high-quality, fresh and local foods to people with different budgets.
Can you describe some of the history? It started back in like 1994, right?
Yeah, 94. Good Food Box really came out of a response to the food banks that had been established and the acknowledgement of the limitations of the food banks. That, food banks are largely distributing processed food into the population, and they do have some effect of alleviating hunger, but they don't really provide great nutrition. We also wanted to encourage people to cook more from raw ingredients, because that's also having that knowledge also makes us a lot more efficient. If we can cook from raw ingredients, we can buy less expensive inputs and produce good quality food for our families at a reasonable rate. So the Good Food Box, we packed 48 in 1994. They went out to individual homes. We had one box at that time. Now we do 9 different versions of the Good Food Box, and they go out into, we pack 4,000 boxes a month now. It's really important that people maintain dignity about how they bring food into their homes. Even though it's a set, the array of produce is set, just because for the logistics of our own system to make it practical, we are sensitive to cultural needs, and so we do reflect the cultures of Toronto, so people will recognize themselves and their own culinary traditions when they open that box as well.
And you guys seem to, like, I know you include like a newsletter in mm-hmm. the food box. How is like education a factor, like urban gardening, does that factor into it?
100%, and we're fortunate at being at FoodShare because we have colleagues under our own umbrella who do really vital work animating urban gardens in Toronto, as well as other programs that teach student nutrition and cooking skills to students. Our belief is that all students should be have food literacy in order to graduate from high school. That we all need to be able to cook for ourselves, grow food for ourselves, understand where our food comes from, understand composting, the end of that cycle, and so that we can really participate in an active way in the production and consumption of our food. Not to be passive consumers, but to be active participants in that system. I think more and more people are wanting to buy more directly. They want to know that a larger percentage of the retail price that they're paying is going to the farmer and less to the many hands that stand between farmers and consumers. And we were really happy to kind of provide a model for some of this distribution. And for us, it's never about empire building. If things were to develop to such a point that we are redundant, no one would be happier than us. We would love to see local sustainable food systems and networks get so strong and so broad and so intense and varied that people could find all these different ways into the food system that would get good quality nutrition into their home in a way that sustained farmers over the long term as well. When we were looking around in the 90s for models, there was a group of academics who went to Brazil and found what's called a sacolão market. And sacolão just means like big bag. And so they're like bulk produce markets. And there is a tradition of them all over Brazil, but what the government started doing was opening sacolão markets in at-needs communities And the nature of one of these places is you walk, you can go in, and you everything is one price. So it's the same price per kilo. So you just take a big bag, you put everything in, and then you weigh it up at the end and you pay for it. What was done in these neighborhoods was the government would support some of the cost of the infrastructure, and so that the people, the end users, were paying about half what would be the normal cost. And there was no controlled access to them. Mm-hmm. So it was just a way of maximizing people's budget for fresh fruits and vegetables. And then the government also ran outside of out of the transit depots, other similar markets with subsidized prices on pasta and grains and beans. So this is a very meat-based, the food culture of Brazil is very heavily meat-based. So, but the government saw the sense of subsidizing the other inputs into the diet to encourage people to consume more of those. So there's obviously a benefit to hunger alleviation, but also shifting people's diet to a healthier balance at the same time.
As Nicole and I prodded Paul for information regarding his program, we found him particularly skilled at speaking about the issues regarding class and access to nutritious food. Some problematic aspects of contemporary food literacy programs are the issues of cost and community.
Certainly food and community are central to what we do. I think the Good Food Box is one example of that. I think a better example really are our good food markets. And those are cases in which a community that feels that it's underserved in terms of access to fresh fruits and vegetables can themselves, along with a little bit of support from us, develop a market in their own community. Yes, we run a number of good food markets across Toronto, or we service a number of good food markets. And they're generally in areas around the periphery of Toronto that they don't really have easy access to grocery stores. It might be we supply the produce to that market, and then that market becomes a social nexus for people to get together to exchange ideas around food, and most importantly, discover the resources that already exist within the community and share those resources so they can establish their own food sovereignty. So that as a community, they're protecting their right to have a secure supply of food.
One facet of the Good Food Box that I found particularly interesting was the fact that they had an online resource library. Their website directed you to all kinds of articles about health and food and recipes you can make from the food that they distribute in their Good Food Box. A lot of them were actually quite academic. The resource library was very well organized, and I found myself spending quite a lot of time browsing through the articles. I asked Paul about his ideas and intentions between free sharing of information on the internet and how it correlated with the Good Food Box and the ambitions of the program.
From number one, just, you know, I'm glad you noticed all the resources that are there, and that's our model is to develop these resources and to model systems that we think can be replicated by others, and to offer them on an open source basis, you know, and for other community groups to take. You know, there's no licensing, there's nothing like that. We've developed them, we want to see other people use them. To us, that's success. In terms of where people's food cultures are, we know that time constraint is a huge part of this. A lot of the households we deal with are single adult households. So there is this push towards processed food out of a time consideration. I think one of the things we like to do is through our newsletter is to illustrate simple, tasty cooking methods that people can assess easily.
The Good Food Box works outside of the framework of food banks because, as Paul says, statistics show, many lower-income peoples try to avoid charity-based food programs. So adjusting prices to fit lower incomes proves to be a more effective method of getting nutritious local food into people's homes.
In terms of cost, cheap food is only apparently cheap. And if you do factor in, number one, the lost nutritional value, and the fact that these processed foods, there are a lot of hidden costs already embedded in them. And then as a society, of course, we're paying huge costs in terms of the environmental effect of that long chain distribution system that's very inefficient. In terms of the health costs that are incurred from eating those foods, you know, that's going to cost us all collectively as well. So cheap food is only apparently cheap because so many of its environmental and social costs are downloaded generally onto the population and not reflected in the final price of that food. But we all pay for it eventually anyways.
This leg of our trip in Ontario brought about more questions. What are the limits of organic in other areas of agriculture? How feasible is Paul's model in the long run? And how many other programs have a similar mandate? And ultimately, what will become of small farms like Duncan's when land is suffering from the impacts of climate change and growing infrastructure? We continue to explore these ideas in our next episode, which will focus on the transparency of food distributors, helped along by an expert on orange juice.
Something added.
And always delicious.
Something tastes this good. It's nice to know it isn't going to change. Minute Maid. The juice of juices.
Today's program was produced, written, and recorded by Nicole Berkelmans and myself, Chesley Walsh. If you'd like to hear this program again, go to our blog, gastrogirls.blogspot.com, where you can find links to the issues discussed in today's program, and find more information on Duncan, Paul, and other issues of gastronomical importance. Thanks for listening.